Welcome again to Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105, Community Radio in Cambridge, with your host, Robert Louis Abrahamson. This evening, Under Lamplight, you are invited to attend to things circular. Wheels, circles, cycles. And why not? Here in early January, we begin the yearly cycle all over again. It's the time of the year most fitting for us to remember all the rounds of our lives. And how fitting that we are here at Roundabout Studios. Roundabout, get it? Circles. And so you can get in touch with us by email at rla@momentsunderlamplight.com, or on the Facebook page, or on the website momentsunderlamplight.com, where you can find archived shows and many other features. If you enjoy this show, well, the chances are you'll enjoy the other things on the site too. Hey, indulge me for a minute, will you, and let me play again one of my little favorites. My excuse is that it's a circular piece, going round and round the tune with slight variations, passing between piano and guitar, with the bass circling round the same beat off and on. It's less than a minute, but it will pick us up for quite some time. Ready? Here it is, the theme music from Soupy Cells. There, how was that? Were you jumping around the room, at least metaphorically? Okay, let's move on to the sense of cycles, suggesting that we're just going round in circles. We're stuck in a rut, the same things, over and over again. So why even bother? Yes, that temptation of despair, it's so seductive. Well, why not turn it into a sing-song, which is what the Kinks do with their 1981 song Predictable, featuring yet again that familiar Ray Davis character, the woe-begone loser, whose life consists of going out for a walk and then coming back in, and who goes to his office and sits at his desk, predictably just like all the rest. And then it turns a little more bitter. Once we had so many options, once we had dignity and grace, now we have got... what? What is it we have now? Nothing but our own time to waste. And then the big question we all would like to know the answer to. Why can't it be like never before? Why can't it be like never before? Well, of course, it can always be like never before if we just open up in mindfulness to all the details around us. Always changing, never really predictable. But that kind of attentiveness requires a change of heart, and sometimes such a change does not occur. We're just weighted down by it all. This is a fitting predicament for Ray Davis' persona of the loser, whom we can take an ironic view of, and that can make things a little better, such as in the kink in the song, the line that turns the whole thing into absurdity, but just makes it all more poignant. All this predictability is just like the stain on my tie. Oh, yes, of course. You wear your favorite tie, and isn't it just predictable that they'll serve some sloppy pasta dish that will inevitably drip right onto the tie? You can see, I hope, the way the balance is so delicate here, leading to despair, but cheerfully playing with the possibilities and ironies. Add to this the driving Kinks music and the rollicking chorus taunting us with predictable, sung at the end of each line. Here, attend for yourself. That was the Kinks, giving us predictable. It's harder and harder the harder I try. Well, maybe you should stop trying. Turn on the TV, just sit and stare. There's nothing happening there. Well, I could have told you that. This isn't a circle, man. It's what we call a rut. And probably when you're caught in a rut, going round and round in circles, the only way to get out is through someone else's help. Or maybe you have to become so intense, even intensely bored, that you can become a wheel on fire rolling down the road. Just notify my next of kin, this wheel shall explode. Well, that's better than being in a rut now, isn't it? Remember that we shall meet again if your memory serves you well. And that meeting, I can tell, may be a recurrence, but it will not be predictable.
If your memory serves you well, we're going to meet again and wait. So I'm going to unpack all my things and sit before it gets too late. No matter what, we'll come to you with another tale to tell. And you know that we shall meet again if your memory serves you well. Wheels on fire, rolling down the road. Just notify my next of kin, this wheel shall explode. If your memory serves you well, I was going to confiscate your lace and wrap it up in a sailor's knot and hide it in your case. If I knew for sure that it was yours, and it was oh so hard to tell, you know that we shall be.
That was the band with a Bob Dylan Rick Danko song, Wheels on Fire, from the first album from the band called Music from Big Pink. And yes, I was there, well, sort of. Lost on the Edges is more like it, as a group of us made a pilgrimage to West Saugerties in upstate New York, looking for that pink split-level house we saw on the album cover. Fan Wheels on Fire, rolling down the turnpike. But we never found any pink houses there. Today it would be easy with online map and spying applications, but it was all hard copy back then, kids. We just drove around the area in circles, ruts, I guess, until it all got predictable and we left for somewhere else. Another kind of running in circles takes place on a verbal or logical level and involves the rut of begging the question. First, allow me to be pedantic for a minute and to point out that contrary to almost universal popular usage, to beg the question is not the same thing as to raise the question. People say things like, "She got lost just driving around the corner. That begs the question of whether she should be driving at all." But it doesn't really beg the question in the true sense, it just raises the question. The logical fallacy of begging the question also has the impressive name of petitio principii, a petition, in some sense a begging, of the beginning of the argument, that is, assuming the truth of what you're basing your argument on. That's where the circle comes in. Why are almonds your favorite kind of nut? Because I like almonds better than any other nut. That does not answer the question. It begs it or avoids it, just restating the question as an answer. Of course a favorite food is the one you like better than others. That's part of the definition. You're stuck in a rut, and what's more, you're dragging me into it with you. Here's another one, which will also serve as a station identification. You're listening to Evening Under Lamplight, because that is the name of the show you're listening to. Are you getting dizzy? Here's another piece of circular reasoning. This is Cambridge 105, community radio in Cambridge. Why is that circular? Because Cambridge 105 is the community radio here in Cambridge. It's part of our definition, man. Circular reasoning can be very dangerous because it can look so foolproof, and yet it addresses nothing in the real world and only plays abstract games. It gets us nowhere. Predictable again, stuck in a rut. But its absurdity can also be funny, often in a sardonic fashion, as in this rather gruesome short fable by Robert Louis Stevenson. The Sick Man and the Fireman. There was once a sick man in a burning house, to whom there entered a fireman. "Do not save me," said the sick man, "save those who are strong." "Will you kindly tell me why?" inquired the fireman, but he was a civil fellow. "Nothing could possibly be fairer," said the sick man. "The strong should be preferred in all cases, because they are of more service in the world." The fireman pondered for a while, for he was a man of some philosophy. "Granted," said he at last, as a part of the roof fell in, "but for the sake of conversation, what would you lay down as the proper service of the strong?" "Nothing could possibly be easier," returned the sick man. "The proper service of the strong is to help the weak." Again the fireman reflected, for there was nothing hasty about this excellent creature. "I could forgive your being sick," he said at last, as a portion of the wall fell out, "but I cannot bear your being such a fool." And with that he heaved up his fireman's axe, for he was eminently just, and clove the sick man to the bed. We followed the circular reasoning of the sick man in the burning room with a set of reels, circle dances, of course, performed by Steel Eye Span on their album Almanac. And what was that circular reasoning again? Did you get it? The strong, brave fireman rushes into the burning house to save the sick man, but the sick man tells him not to waste time saving him. The fireman should instead save the strong people. Why? Because the strong people have an important job to do in the world. What's that important job? Well, as the sick man says, the proper service of the strong is to help the weak. But of course, if there's a choice between helping the weak and helping someone who is strong, they should, by this reasoning, help the strong person first because we need that strong person to help the weak. In other words, the circle goes round and round, always promising to help the weak, but never actually doing so. Wait, does this sound like the politics of corporate business? We need to save the banks so they can help us little guys, but before they can help the little guys, they first have to give themselves big bonuses so the bankers will be satisfied with their jobs and can then go help the little guys, but, well, and so on. You get the picture. And all the time, the burning house is collapsing all around this logical absurdity. Feh! Let's move away from that onto another kind of circle. Let's look at some wheels. There is the mystical wheel, the wheels of the Merkaba, the spiritual chariot the prophet Ezekiel saw in his vision. Here's part of what he saw. And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud, and a fire enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it. Also out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures. Now as I beheld the living creatures, behold, one wheel upon the earth by the living creatures with his four faces. The appearance of the wheels and their work was like unto the color of a beryl, and they four had one likeness, and their appearance and their work was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. When they went upon their four sides, and they turned not when they went. Do you find these lines hard to understand? Well, of course. They are mystical lines, and by tradition, only the initiated can understand the importance of this Merkava, these wheels bringing us the divine presence. Maybe the best way to put it is in T.S. Eliot's image of the dance around the still point, the hub of the wheel. At the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards, at the still point, there the dance is, but neither a rest nor movement. And do not call it fixity, where past and future are gathered, neither movement from nor towards, neither ascent nor decline. Except for the point, the still point, there would be no dance, and there is only the dance. We are on the wheel as our life spins around, but there is that still center that both is and is not. It cannot be labeled, only hinted at through images and paradoxes, which is what also makes it a good myth, appealing to children, to fools, and to the wise, each at a different level. Here's the choir of the Tuskegee Institute singing for us the spiritual based upon Ezekiel's vision. Ezekiel saw the wheel way up in the middle of the air, and the big wheel run by faith, and the little wheel run by the grace of God, a wheel in a wheel way up in the middle of the air.
Ezekiel saw the wheel way up in the middle of the air. Ezekiel saw the wheel way in the middle of the air. Ezekiel saw the wheel way up in the middle of the air. Ezekiel saw the wheel way in the middle of the air.
Wheel,
wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel, wheel,
Was the Tuskegee Institute Choir singing Ezekiel Saw the Wheel. The imagery from the book of Ezekiel reappears in the Rider-Waite tarot card of the Wheel of Fortune, which features a wheel at the center of the card with the letters T-A-R-O around the rim, spelling out tarot, T-A-R-O, and T again because it's a circle. And also rota, R O-T-A, Latin for wheel. Alternating with the Roman letters T-A-R-O are the Hebrew letters Yud-He-Vuv-He, the tetragram, the holy name of God, not to be pronounced by us. Thus we can see the sacredness of the wheel inscribed with God's most intimate name. Around the wheel are three weird creatures, a sphinx, a sinuous snake, and some odd demonic creature. At the four corners of the card, resting each on a cloud, are four winged figures, a man or an angel, an eagle, an ox, and a lion. These figures, all taken from that first chapter of Ezekiel, sometimes represent the four Gospels, but always represent a sense of completion. One at each corner, stable and sure and balanced and dependable. And so it is with that wheel, turning but not out of control, though not in our control, that's for sure. And this represents the Wheel of Fortune, after all. It represents our fortune, or to put it in everyday language, it represents how life turns out for us every day. Did we burn the toast at breakfast? Did the rain hold off until we got onto the bus? Did we find an envelope in our desk with £50 cash in it, which we'd hidden away last year and then forgot about? In traditional classical myth, fortune is depicted as a woman on a wheel, or a ball, signifying that our fortunes keep turning. That's the one constant. Fortune, or we might say circumstance, the arrangement of things in our world, is never constant. Yet here we are spending our lives hoping to place some fix on our fortunes, put the brakes on that wheel and have it stay where it is right now, at least when things are going well. When they're not going well, then we somehow want to get that wheel spinning a little faster. Dame Fortune is also an image of what we could call luck. There's no way to control her movements. We just have to bear up as best we can with the knowledge that things change. Good luck, buddy. Do you worry about luck? Do you have superstitions about how to control your luck? Sports is an activity where so much is down to chance. The bounce of a ball, the sun in a player's eyes, a small stumble while running. And sports people seem to be more superstitious than most. Wearing their lucky underwear for the big match, or always sitting in the same place on the bench. Gamblers too, of course, none more so, since so much of gambling is just dependent on luck, and of course, nerves. And here it's time for a wee break. Let's have a song, and I suppose there's no other song we can attend to now than that tribute to Dame Fortune from Guys and Dolls, Luck Be a Lady. It's a little slick for my taste, but I can bear it if you can.
They call you Lady Luck, but there is room for doubt. At times you have a very unladylike way of running out. You're on a date with me, the pickings have been lush, and yet before this evening is over you might give me the brush. You might forget your manners, you might refuse to stay, and so the best that I can do is pray. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck, if you've ever been a lady to begin with, luck be a lady tonight. Luck, let a gentleman see how nice a dame you can be. I know the way you've treated other guys you've been with. Luck be a lady with me. A lady doesn't leave her escort. It isn't fair, it isn't nice. A lady doesn't wander all over the room and blow on some other guy's dice. So let's keep the party polite. Never get out of my sight. Stick with me, baby, I'm the fella you came in with. Luck be a lady. Luck be a lady. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck, let a gentleman see how nice a dame you can be. I know the way you treated other guys you've been with. Luck, be a lady with me. A lady wouldn't flirt with strangers. She'd have a heart, she'd have a soul. A lady wouldn't make little snake eyes at me when I've bet my life on this roll. So let's keep the party polite.
Let's keep the party polite.
Never get out of my sight.
Never get out of my sight.
Stick with me, baby, I'm the fella you came in with. Luck be a lady.
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 Well, I suppose that's how guys treat their dolls, and expect their dolls to treat them. A little odd to me, though. But let's move on to some further considerations of Dame Fortune. Not some cool New York version, but the medieval version in Dante. At the end of Canto 7 of the Inferno, Virgil explains to Dante the myth of fortune. Like the traditional classical image, Fortune, or Fortuna, is portrayed as a lady, Dame Fortune, turning on her wheel. Her changing changes never take a rest. Necessity keeps her in constant motion, as men come and go to take their turn with her. But the wheel's turning is not arbitrary. It turns in accordance with divine providence. So even though our changes in circumstance may seem completely arbitrary to us here, that is, a product of sheer luck, seen from a larger perspective, there is a pattern created, though we cannot know it, only trust in it, or not trust in it, of course. As with all great art, we need to see this figure in context. It is significant that Virgil is explaining to Dante about Dame Fortune just before the two of them cross the marsh of anger. What is Dante saying to us by placing fortune next to anger? Is Dante suggesting that anger has something to do with the constant change in the world? Of course we're frustrated that we can't control our world. We carry good luck charms, we take out insurance policies, some of us even stay in bed on Friday the 13th, but we still can't control our circumstances. Dame Fortune is in control, but keeps quiet about how she operates. The saintly person recognizes the hand of God here, but most of the rest of us rage in frustration. Thinking too much about fortune, about our luck, leads us straight into the mire of anger. How? I think of a time not that long ago when our puppy came bounding in from a walk, excited and jumpy, and bumped into a chair, which slid into a table and knocked over a special ornamental bowl, which then smashed onto the floor. Oops! There's the hand of Fortuna, changing things, even in just this little way. The wheel turned a little bit. One moment the bowl is there, the next its pieces are being swept up to be put into the bin. But I grew very angry, partly at myself for not controlling the dog better, partly at whoever decided to leave that bowl on the table, when they knew people go past there every day, and mostly, alas, at the puppy for being, well, puppyish. But what Dante wants me to realize is that I was angry because I could not control what I was doing. I forgot that I wasn't the king of the fortune wheel. There are so many circumstances that remain out of my control. Can I be graceful and acknowledge my vulnerability with a smile? That was a problem facing the anonymous hero of a very powerful 20th century American short story, The King of the Bingo Game, by Ralph Ellison. Written in the mid-40s, the story tells of a black man who has migrated from the South to the North. There is no longer the segregation and the constant threat of violence that he knew in the South, but there is also none of that friendly helpfulness from the black community. Here in the North, he's on his own, and he's alienated from both black and white society. It's no mistake that he has no name. He's a nobody as far as anyone else is concerned. He's also, of course, every man. He represents us all. And he's also the prototype of the hero of Ellison's most famous work, The Invisible Man. The action of the story takes place in a bingo hall. First, there is the picture show, a movie, some B or C movie, with titillating pictures of the hero bursting into the room to find the girl tied to a bed, her legs and arms spread wide, and her clothing torn to rags. He's obsessed, though, with the way everything seems fixed in the world. Everything is fixed, he thinks. Now, suppose when they showed that girl with her dress torn, the girl started taking off the rest of her clothes, and when the guy came in, he didn't untie her but kept her there and went to taking off his own clothes. That would be something to see. But of course it would never happen. Too exciting to allow people to see. This was 1944, remember, a time of extreme censorship of all public entertainment. Everything was fixed. He is sitting there hungry and lonely and drops off into a sleep, but is haunted by an old nightmare. Now a dreamy music was accompanying the film, and train whistles were sounding in the distance, and he was a boy again walking along a railroad trestle down south, and seeing the train coming and running back as fast as he could go, and hearing the whistle blowing and getting off the trestle to solid ground just in time, with the earth trembling beneath his feet and feeling relieved as he ran down the cinder-strewn embankment onto the highway, and looking back and seeing with terror that the train had left the track and was following him right down the middle of the street, and all the white people laughing as he ran screaming. But soon the movie is over and it's time to start the bingo game. The man has tried to push his luck by somehow getting hold of 5 bingo cards, which he's trying to play all together in his lap. And the odd thing is, he actually wins. Bingo! And this means he gets to come up onto the stage and play the Wheel of Fortune, which is projected onto the screen. If he gets 00, then he wins tonight's jackpot, all of $36.90, a joke sum to us today, but a substantial fortune then. and just what he needs to pay the doctor to come see his wife, Laura, who's terribly sick back home. He can't get a job or welfare because he has no birth certificate. Playing his luck is his only hope. And now his chance has come. He just has to press the little button at the end of a cord which starts the wheel spinning. When he takes his finger off the button, the wheel will stop. That's fine in theory, but once he holds that button down and the wheel is spinning, he enters, well, some private world of madness. Let's hear how Ellison puts it. Trembling, he pressed the button. There was a whirl of lights, and in a second he realized with finality that though he wanted to, he could not stop. It was as though he held a high-powered line in his naked hand. His nerves tightened. As the wheel increased its speed, it seemed to draw him more and more into its power, as though it held his fate. And with it came a deep need to submit, to whirl, to lose himself in its swirl of color. He could not stop it now, he knew, so let it be. The button rested snugly in his palm where the man had placed it. And now he became aware of the man beside him, advising him through the microphone, while behind, the shadowy audience hummed with noisy voices. He shifted his feet. There was still that feeling of helplessness within him, making part of him desire to turn back, even now that the jackpot was right in his hand. He squeezed the button until his fist ached. Then, like the sudden shriek of a subway whistle, a doubt tore through his head. Suppose he did not spin the wheel long enough. What could he do and how could he tell? And then he knew, even as he wondered, that as long as he pressed the button, he could control the jackpot. He and only he could determine whether or not it was to be his. Not even the man with the microphone could do anything about it now. He felt drunk. He watched the wheel whirling past the numbers and experienced a burst of exultation. This is God. This is the really, truly God. He said it aloud. This is God. Of course, the white man running the show starts to interfere with this guy who's taking too long in the spotlight. But he pushes the man aside and loses awareness of the man and the audience yelling. He was like a long black wire that was being stretched and wound upon the bingo wheel. Wound until he wanted to scream. Wound, but this time himself controlling the winding and the sadness and the shame. And because he did, Laura would be all right. Suddenly the lights flickered. He staggered backward. Had something gone wrong? All this noise. Didn't they know that although he controlled the wheel, it also controlled him, and unless he pressed the button forever and forever and ever, it would stop, leaving him high and dry, dry and high on this hard, high, slippery hill, and Laura dead? There was only one chance, and he had to do whatever the wheel demanded. And gripping the button in despair, he discovered with surprise that it imparted a nervous energy. His spine tingled. He felt a certain power. Now he faced the raging crowd with defiance, its screams penetrating his eardrums like trumpets shrieking from a jukebox. The vague faces glowing in the bingo lights gave him a sense of himself that he had never known before. He was running the show, by God. They had to react to him, for his was their luck. This was me, he thought. Let the bastards yell. Then someone was laughing inside him, and he realized that somehow he had forgotten his own name. It was a sad, lost feeling to lose your name, and a crazy thing to do. That name had been given him by the white man who had owned his grandfather a long, lost time ago down south. Well, he didn't need that old name. He was reborn. For as long as he pressed the button, he was the man who pressed the button, who held the prize, who was the king of the bingo. That was the way it was, and he'd have to press the button even if nobody understood, even though Laura did not understand. "Live!" he shouted. The audience quieted like the dying of a huge fan. "Live, Laura, baby! I got hold of it now, sugar! Live!" He screamed at tears streaming down his face. "I got nobody but you!" Well, anyone can guess what happens next. Two men in uniform beckoned from the end of the stage. Uh-oh, the cops. He tries to run, but since he cannot let go of the button, he can run only as far as the cord will let him, and he ends up running in circles. There's the circle again. Running in circles on the stage to avoid the men in uniform. But the men grab him, knock him to the ground, and stamp on his wrist to make him let go. "I can't give it up," he screamed. Then quietly, in a confidential tone, "Boys, I really can't give it up." Too bad. A kick comes to his head, and he realizes the button's been taken away. He looks up and notices the wheel has come to a stop at 00. "You see?" he pointed bitterly. He still thinks he's going to get his prize money, but we know. Suddenly the curtain, weighted with lead, of course, comes down right onto his head. He only felt the dull pain exploding in his skull, and he knew, even as it slipped out of him, that his luck had run out on the stage. How else to follow Ralph Ellison's King of the Bingo Game than with K-Star's Wheel of Fortune? Ellison's story is not easy to find. You have to find it in the collection of his stories called Flying Home and Other Stories. But then you get 12 other stories too, all very moving, though perhaps not quite as existentially complex as this story. Now there's one more sense of wheels and cycles we'll look at. Karma, the cycle of getting back what you give out. All comes round like a turning wheel. We'll have Dylan take us through the rounds here with his song, Do Right to Me, Baby, Do Unto Others. From the album Slow Train Coming, one of his evangelical albums and hence not very well known, but we are the losers if we neglect these songs. The song has a deceptively simple style, all sorts of ornamentations around the basic tune and rhythm, and the words presenting us another Dylan catalogue with the usual quirks. Don't want to learn from nobody what I gotta unlearn. A kind of hypnotic list of self-reflective half lines. What I don't want and thus what I won't do unto others. All the negatives turning into positives. But are you a little bothered by the chorus? If you do right to me, baby, I'll do right to you too. Does that imply that if you don't do right by me, I'll feel free to be as cruel as I want to you? What happened to turning the other cheek? Well, the whole point of turning the other cheek is to break the vicious cycle of hitting back, and this song does not take us out of the cycle, which is why we include it here tonight. The song comprises 5 4-line stanzas with 34 don't wannas and 1 don't put. Don't put my faith in nobody, not even a scientist. That's not quite a circle, but it certainly has a barb to it. So here, attend to this as we ease our way out at the end of another evening under lamplight on Cambridge 105 with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, wishing you a good night and reminding you of the karmic circle you gotta do unto others like you'd have them do unto you. But don't take my word for it. Here's Dylan himself to tell you.
I don't wanna be amused. But if you do right, baby. I'll do right to you too. Got to do unto others like you have them. Say like you have them. Do unto you. Don't want to betray nobody. Don't want to be betrayed. Don't want to play with nobody. Don't want to be waylaid. Don't want to miss nobody. Don't want to be missed. Don't put my faith in nobody, not even a scientist. But if you do right to me, baby, I'll do right to you too. You got to do unto others like you have them. Like you have them. Do unto you.
So, good night, and see you next time.